Thank you for joining us for Financial News. My name is Michael Amy. Title of this article is Lending Your Child Money to Buy a Home. This was published at interest.com. Lending money to your child is risky business, but if you can avoid the personal pitfalls and convince the federal government that this is really a loan and not a gift, the bank of mom and dad can be a financial boon for everyone in the family. Your baby is all grown up and ready to buy a home. Sally or John could go to a traditional lender to get a mortgage, or she or he could turn to the bank of mom and dad. Should you lend your child money to buy a home? If Sally or John defaults, you have to foreclose on your own child. Can you handle that? On the other hand, you can earn close to 3% on a long-term loan, which is considerably more than with a savings account or certificate of deposit. Your child will save on closing costs, private mortgage insurance, and interest because the cheapest traditional 30-year loans charge well more than the rate that you could offer. Most parents don't lend their children money to buy a home, but it's not unheard of. Somewhere around 6% of first-time home buyers receive a loan from a friend or relative. If you're considering lending your child money, here are five facts you need to know. Fact 1. Lending money can cause conflict. The single most important consideration is whether you can afford to have your money tied up in a loan for an extended period. Generally, families that are able to provide mortgages for their children have greater wealth, says Jeff Nauta, a certified financial planner and principal at Hendrickson Nauta Wealth Advisors in Belmont, Michigan. If you think you'll rely on the mortgage payments to finance your own retirement, then late or missed payments can put you in a tough situation. You know your child. Make sure that she or he is already financially independent before considering a loan. You should not be the bank of last resort. You need to evaluate the loan much like a bank would, which means knowing your child's credit and job history. Often, the potential for tension outweighs the financial considerations. The parent-child relationship may become strained when you loan the money and are not repaid correctly, or the child is constantly paying late or buying things that the parent feels are improper or causing late payments, says Tim Gagnon, Associate Academic Specialist of Accounting at Northeastern University's DeMoor McKim School of Business in Boston. Can you foreclose on your child? Can you evict your child, and will they see you as the first payment they should make each month? Gagnon asks. Can you create a business relationship without emotions with your child? Fact 2. You must follow the government's rules to avoid the gift tax. If you want to lend your child a large sum, you have to do it right to avoid incurring gift tax liability. First, you must properly document the loan. The parents are going to have to work with a title company to create the required deed of trust documents and record these with the county in which the residence is located, says Kevin McCacken, a certified financial planner and principal of Mosaic Financial Partners in San Francisco. This will secure their interest in the property. A promissory note and mortgage should be executed between the parents and child, he says. Without this, the parents' financial interest in the property could be jeopardized were the child to lose the house to creditors. It also provides evidence that the funds provided are a loan and not a gift. The formal loan document should state the loan's interest rate, terms, and transferability. McGahan says it should also include an amortization table showing the balance remaining and equity accrued at any point in the loan's lifespan. To determine what interest rate to charge, you'll need to go to the IRS.gov site and look up the applicable federal rate for the month and year in which you finalize the loan. During June 2019, for example, the applicable federal rate for long-term loans was 2.72% if the interest is compounded monthly. That's 1.34 percentage points less than the average 30-year mortgage interest rate. There are significant and complicated tax consequences if you don't charge at least this amount. Failure to do so could create a gift, or the IRS could deem the uncharged interest to be income and tax it. Also, if parents forgive the loan or don't pursue collection actions, the IRS may consider it a gift, Gagnon says, and if the loan is forgiven, the child may have to report it as income and pay tax on it. Gift tax issues are complicated. Yet another reason why you should engage competent professionals to help you structure the loan and understand all of the details. For 2019, the annual gift tax exclusion is $15,000. This amount applies to each recipient, and each spouse can give this amount tax-free. The maximum amount parents could give a child without incurring gift tax liability would be $30,000 if each parent gave $15,000 to both their child and the child's spouse. Even the maximum amount is far less than most mortgages. Fact 3. You must follow rules to deduct mortgage interest. Following the steps to avoid the gift tax will get you most of the way toward making sure your child can deduct mortgage interest payments. Here are the additional steps. The parents should issue their child an IRS Form 1098 to report the interest the child paid on the loan over the course of the year. The 1098 tells the child how much interest to claim as a tax deduction on his or her tax return. The parents should declare the interest earned on the loan through IRS Form 1099 and report it as income on their tax returns. The 1098 and 1099 should match. Fact number 4. There are companies that can help you formalize your loan agreement. A third-party financial institution can simplify the loan process and increase the likelihood your child will pay you back. One such intermediary is Boston-based National Family Mortgage, which has handled more than $400 million in loans while keeping more than $180 million of interest within families. More than 4 of every 5 of National Family Mortgage's loans are between parents and their adult children. Fees for this service run from $725 for loans of $100,000 or less to $2,100 for loans of $1 million or more. For an additional $15 a month, National Family will service the loan by sending monthly statements, collecting payments, and providing year-end tax forms. The company says the default rate is less than 1% on the loans it manages. Fact number 5. This type of loan won't show up on credit reports. A loan between family members cannot build or damage the borrower's credit because it's not reported to credit agencies. Parents can't report the loan to the credit bureaus, even if they want to, because TransUnion, Experian, and Equifax have rigid, cumbersome, and expensive reporting requirements that few family lenders can meet, according to Tim Burke, the CEO of National Family Mortgage. The agencies also have legitimate concerns that intrafamilial loans have an inherently biased creditor relationship and could be abused to help a borrower build credit. If a child missed a mortgage payment, the parent might be tempted to grant amnesty by informing the credit agencies that no payment was due. Title of that article is Lending Your Child Money to Buy a Home. It's posted at interest.com. This article is titled The Tax Smart Way to Loan Money to Family Members, published on May 21st, 2019 at marketwatch.com. You may want to help a young family member buy a first home or help a financially challenged relative or friend by loaning that person some money. Nice thought, but if you follow through, please make it a tax smart loan. This column explains how to avoid adverse tax consequences when you make a personal loan to a relative or friend. The interest rate issue. Most loans to family members or friends are below market loans in tax lingo. Below market means loan that charges no interest or a rate below the applicable federal rate, that is the AFR. AFRs are the minimum interest rates you can charge without creating unwanted tax side effects for yourself. AFRs are set by the government, and they can potentially change every month. Right now, AFRs are still very low by historical standards, so making a loan that charges the AFR instead of a lower rate or 0% rate makes good sense. Reason? You can give the borrower, your relative or friend, a sweet interest rate deal without causing tax complications for yourself. For term loans, those with specified repayment dates, the relative AFR is the rate in effect for loans of that duration for the month that you make the loan. Here are the AFRs for term loans made in May of this year. For a short-term loan with a term of 3 years or less, made that month, the AFR is 2.37%, assuming monthly compounding. The AFR for a midterm loan, over 3 years but not more than 9 years, is only 2.35%. Yes, that's lower than the short-term rate. Go figure. And thirdly, the AFR for a long-term loan, more than 9 years, is only 2.7%. The same AFR continues to apply over the life of the term loan, regardless of how interest rates may fluctuate. As you can see, these AFRs are much lower than rates charged by commercial lenders. However, as long as you charge at least the AFR on a loan to a family member or friend, you don't have to worry about any of the tax complications explained later in this column. You make a 5-year term loan to your beloved nephew in May of 2019 and charge an interest rate of exactly 2.35% with monthly compounding. The AFR for midterm loans made during May. You'll have taxable interest income based on that rate for the life of the loan. Your nephew will have an equal amount of interest expense, which may or may not be deductible depending on how the loan proceeds are used. Tax-wise, that's all you need to know about the interest rate issue. So if you decide to charge the AFR, you can ignore most of the rest of this column. However, if you insist on charging less than the AFR, you'll need to read the whole thing. Sorry. Rates for demand loans. If you make a demand loan, that is one that you can call due at any time instead of a term loan, the AFR for each year will be blended rate that reflects monthly changes in the short-term rate. So with a demand loan, the annual blended AFR can change dramatically, depending on how general interest rates move. This creates uncertainty for both you and the borrower. In contrast, making a term loan that charges the current AFR avoids any interest rate uncertainty because the same AFR will apply for the entire life of the loan. Warning, get your loan in writing. Regardless of the interest rate you intend to charge, if any, you want to be able to prove that you intended the transaction to be a loan rather than an outright gift. That way, if the loan goes bad, you can claim a non-business bad debt deduction on your Form 1040 for the year you get the bad news. Losses from non-business bad debts are classified as short-term capital losses. Capital losses are valuable because they can offset capital gains and potentially up to $3,000 of income from other sources, or up to $1,500 if you use married filing separate status. Any remaining net capital loss gets carried forward to the next year and will be subject to the same rules next year. Without a written document, your intended loan will probably be characterized as a gift by the IRS, and that's if you get audited. Then, if the loan goes bad, you won't be able to claim any non-business bad debt loss deduction. In fact, you won't be able to deduct anything because ill-advised gifts do not result in deductible losses. To avoid this problem, your loan should be evidenced by a written promissory note that includes the following details. The interest rate, if any, a schedule showing dates and amounts for interest and principal repayments, the security of collateral for the loan, if any, and make sure the borrower signs the note. If your relative or friend will be using the loan proceeds to buy a home and you are charging interest, be sure to have the note legally secured by the residents. Otherwise, the borrower can't deduct the interest as qualified home mortgage interest. At the time you make the loan, it's also a good idea to write a memo to your tax file documenting reasons why it seemed reasonable to think you would be repaid. This supports your contention that the transaction was always intended to be a loan rather than an outright gift. As I just explained, the tax results are straightforward if your loan will charge an interest rate that equals or exceeds the AFR. But if you insist on charging less or nothing, you'll have to finesse the tax rules in order to avoid unpleasant surprises. Here's what you need to know. When you make a below-market loan, that is, one that charges an interest rate below the AFR, to a relative or friend, our beloved Internal Revenue Code treats you as making an imputed gift to the borrower. The imaginary gift equals the difference between the AFR interest you should have charged and the interest you actually charged, if any. The borrower is then deemed to pay these phantom dollars back to you as imputed interest income. Although this is all fictional, you must still report the imputed interest as taxable income on your Form 1040. The resulting extra federal income tax hit is not fictional. Fortunately, you can usually dodge this problem via the following two loopholes. First, the $10,000 loophole. For small below-market loans, the IRS lets you ignore the imputed gift and imputed interest income rules. To qualify for this loophole, any and all loans between you and the borrower in question must aggregate to $10,000 or less. If you pass this test, you can forget all the nonsense about imputed gift and interest. Beware, the $10,000 aggregate loan limit applies to all outstanding loans between you and the borrower, whether or not they charge interest equal to or above the AFR. Key point, you cannot take advantage of the $10,000 loophole if the borrower uses the loan proceeds to buy or carry income-producing assets. The $100,000 loophole. With a larger below-market loan, the $100,000 loophole may save you from tax-related grief. You're eligible for this loophole as long as the aggregate balance of all outstanding loans with below-market interest or otherwise between you and the borrower is $100,000 or less. Income tax consequences under this loophole. The taxable imputed interest income to you is zero as long as the borrower's net investment income for the year is no more than $1,000. If the borrower's net investment income exceeds $1,000, your taxable imputed interest income is limited to his or her actual net investment income. The borrower must give you an annual signed statement disclosing his or her net investment income for the year. Keep this document with your tax records. Example 2. You make a $100,000 interest-free loan to your beloved niece who has $200 of net investment income for the year. Your taxable imputed interest income is zero. However, if your niece's net investment income is $1,200, your imputed interest income is $1,200. In most cases, the borrower will have under $1,000 of net investment incomes. If so, you will have zero imputed interest income under the tax rules. And that's good. Gift tax consequences under this loophole. The gift tax results under the $100,000 loophole are tricky, but they will almost never have any meaningful impact under the current federal gift and estate tax regime. Reason? The unified federal gift and estate tax exemption for 2019 is $11.4 million, and the exemption is scheduled to be even bigger next year thanks to an inflation adjustment. Such ultra-generous exemptions mean almost a 0% chance of any negative gift tax consequences from making a below-market loan. But if the Sanders-Warren ticket wins in 2020, you might want to check back with me for an update. Bottom line, as you can see, there are potential tax complications when you are nice enough to make a loan to a family member or friend. But you can avoid the pitfalls by planning and documenting your loan transaction as I've advised here. You are welcome. Title of that article, The Tax Smart Way to Loan Money to Family Members, this by Bill Bischoff at MarketWatch.com. Title of this article, What Can a 529 Be Used For? More Than You May Think. This from unmarriedamerica.com. What constitutes a qualified educational expense? When that question relates to 529 savings plans, the answer may be broader than you think. Although 529 accounts are often used to pay for children's college tuition, those funds can also be used for a variety of qualified expenses. In fact, recent changes to federal law under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 have given investors additional options for how they can spend their 529 plan dollars. Earnings in 529 plans aren't taxed under the federal tax code. Withdrawals for eligible expenses are tax-free, and many states also allow 529 contributions to be deducted from state income taxes. Since the plans are state-sponsored, they differ from state to state with respect to investment options and other features. Here are seven ways to put 529 plans to use. First, use a 529 to pay for elementary and secondary school tuition. Due to 2018 tax reforms, parents can use up to $10,000 saved in 529 accounts to pay tuition for children attending kindergarten through 12th grade. Though the tax-free earnings on withdrawals used for such tuition expenses may not be very high, parents are likely to spend their 529 funds on K-12 tuition immediately, leaving little time for earnings growth. The state tax deduction benefits may be worthwhile. Immediate state-level tax benefits are what will almost certainly draw more people who are paying private school tuition into 529 accounts. Any family paying private school tuition in a state offering 529 tax benefits would be foolish, financially speaking, not to make use of them, experts at the Brookings Institutions said in a recent report. However, advisors and investors should do their homework before assuming that state-level tax benefits are guaranteed. According to Brookings, 16 states have argued that their 529 tax incentives do not apply to K-12 expenses or haven't yet determined whether they do. Second, roll 529 savings into an ABLE account to pay for disability expenses. Achieving a better life experience accounts were established in 2014 to allow people with disabilities and their families to save money for disability-related expenses. Earnings in ABLE accounts grow on a tax-deferred basis and can be withdrawn tax-free for eligible expenses such as housing, transportation, and assistive technology. Like traditional 529 accounts, ABLE accounts can also be used to cover educational expenses. But sometimes parents who have started traditional 529 accounts for their children realize only later, after a child's disability diagnosis, that they would really benefit from an ABLE account. Fortunately, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act offers them some relief. 529 account holders can roll their funds into ABLE accounts up to the annual contribution limit of $15,000 until January 1, 2026. A 529 account can be rolled into an ABLE account for the same beneficiary or for a different beneficiary within the same family. For instance, a family may roll money from a 529 account benefiting one sibling into an ABLE account benefiting another sibling. Third, use a 529 to pay for vocational school, community college, online courses, and graduate programs. Though many associate 529 plans with four-year colleges, they can be used to fund tuition and other educational expenses at a variety of post-secondary institutions and programs, including community colleges, trade and vocational schools, graduate schools, and qualifying online course and degree programs. To determine whether a school or program is eligible for 529 spending, check with its admissions office or search the U.S. Department of Education's accreditation database. Fourth, technology and Internet access can be 529 qualified expenses. In the digital age, education and technology go hand in hand. Fortunately, 529 withdrawals can cover the cost of the purchase of any computer technology, related equipment, and/or related services such as Internet access, according to the IRS. Such equipment includes printers, but not equipment that is intended mainly for entertainment purposes. Computer software used for educational purposes is also covered. Fifth, prepare for a career change by creating a 529 for yourself. 529 plans aren't just for kids and teens. Adults can set up 529s to cover their own educational expenses, which may prove especially handy to those pursuing a change of careers. Joe Hurley, the founder of SavingForCollege.com, used 529 funds to earn a horticulture certificate. Hurley, who began his career as an accountant, now runs a farm. There are a couple of ways adults can take advantage of 529 plans. The most direct way is to open new accounts and designate themselves as the beneficiaries. Parents can also take over existing 529 plans that once benefited their children. For instance, if a child wins a scholarship and her college expenses prove lower than originally anticipated, a new beneficiary in her family, including her parents, can be designated for the account and use its excess funds without facing a tax penalty. Hurley paid for his horticulture courses with his children's leftover 529 funds. Sixth, a 529 can help you save during retirement. 401ks and IRAs are the most popular vehicles for retirement savings, but 529 plans can play a role too, at least for seniors who would rather spend their golden years in a classroom than on the golf course. That's because 529 funds can be used to pay for college courses or continuing education classes at qualifying institutions. Here once again, checking with an institution's admissions office or searching the Department of Education's database can help current and future retirees determine where they can spend their 529 funds. Seventh, 529 plan contributions are tax-advantaged gifts. Whether it's for a birthday, a holiday, or for no reason at all, relatives and friends can use 529 plans to give gifts to the children in their lives. Grandparents, aunts, and uncles, or anyone else wishing to help fund a child's education may contribute to an existing 529 account or open a new one and name the child as the beneficiary. In many states, those contributions can be deducted from state income taxes, although gift givers should remember that gift taxes may apply to contributions exceeding the annual exclusion of $15,000 per recipient, as it's currently constituted, and that amount can change year to year. 529 gifts, however, come with a special tax exemption. Individuals can front-load 5 years' worth of contributions without paying gift taxes. That is, they may make the equivalent of 5 years of maximum contributions, five times $15,000 or $75,000 in a single year. This might be an especially attractive option for those intent on minimizing future estate taxes or anyone contributing cash to a student who could use the funds right away. Today, more than ever, 529 plans can help investors and their children achieve a range of educational and career goals. With the right planning and advice, Americans can save their money while enriching their minds. Title of that article, What Can a 529 Be Used For? More Than You May Think. That posted to unmarriedamerica.com. You're listening to Financial News. My name is Michael Amy. Here's an article posted to PewSocialTrends.org. It's titled, What Unites and Divides Urban, Suburban, and Rural Communities? And it's by Kim Parker, Juliana Menachi Horowitz, Anna Brown, Richard Fry, Vera Cohn, and Ruth Agilnik. Three key demographic forces have reshaped the overall U.S. population in recent years. growing racial and ethnic diversity, increasing immigration, and rising numbers of older adults. But these trends are playing out differently in the nation's rural, urban, and suburban communities, touching some more than others. Likewise, recent U.S. population growth also has been uneven. Urban counties have grown at roughly the overall national rate of 13% since 2000. Suburban and small metropolitan areas have grown more briskly. Rural counties have lagged, and half of them have fewer residents now than they did in 2000. According to a Pew Research Center analysis of census data, since 2000, U.S. urban and suburban populations have grown at least as much as they did over the prior decade. But the total rural population has grown less than it did in the 1990s, when rising numbers fed hope of a modest rural rebound. As a result, a somewhat smaller share of Americans now live in rural counties, 14% versus 16% in 2000. More recently, the Census Bureau's population estimates for 2017 show a one-year uptick in the nation's rural population, although not enough to make up for previous declines. Analysis by demographer Kenneth M. Johnson attributed the increase to gains in rural communities on the edge of metropolitan areas, while more remote counties continued to lose population. The flow of people in and out of different types of U.S. counties is affecting their size and composition. Since 2000, more people left rural counties for urban, suburban, or small metro counties than moved in from those areas. Because there were not enough new immigrants to offset those departures, rural counties, as a group, grew only because they had more births than deaths. At the national level, non-Hispanic whites make up the majority of the population. But a key demographic shift is underway. Whites are shrinking share of the population and expected to be less than half by mid-century as other groups grow more rapidly. Whites have become a minority of the population in most urban counties since 2000, while remaining the majority in 90% of suburban and small metro counties and 89% of rural ones. Another key demographic trend. The rise in immigration in recent decades has raised the foreign-born share of the U.S. population overall and has increased the share in each type of county, although to varying degrees. Immigrants, along with their children and grandchildren, have accounted for the majority of U.S. population growth since 1965. But immigrants are more concentrated in cities and suburbs than in rural areas. On the flip side, the majority of rural areas now have fewer U.S.-born residents than in 2000, a key factor in their dwindling populations. A third major population driver, the aging of the giant baby boom generation, also has varying impacts on different county types. Rural areas have a higher share of adults who are age 65 and older than urban or suburban counties. But suburban counties have experienced the sharpest increases in the number of older adults since 2000. The analysis in this chapter relies mainly on Census Bureau data. Current numbers for county characteristics come from the American Community Survey, that is the ACS, combined data for 2012-2016, the latest available. Current numbers for natural increase, decrease, and migration flows come from population estimates for 2014, the most comparable year to the ACS data because it's the midpoint of the combined ACS data used in this chapter. About 46 million Americans live in the nation's rural counties, 175 million in its suburbs and small metros, and about 98 million in its urban core counties. As a group, the population in rural counties grew 3% since 2000, less than their 8% growth in the 1990s. Urban county populations rose 13% since 2000, and the population in suburban and small metro counties went up 16%, growth rates somewhat higher than in the 1990s. The share of U.S. residents who live in rural counties declined in the 1990s and since 2000, but rose in suburban counties during both periods and held steady in urban counties. Although the rural population as a whole has grown since 2000, the majority of populations in individual rural counties has not. Since the turn of the century, the population declined in 52% of rural counties, 1,024 of 1,969. Among the hardest hit counties were those where the economy is based on farming, about a fifth of rural counties. Growth factors vary for cities, suburbs, and rural areas. There are four main drivers of population gain or loss in the county level: births, deaths, new immigrants coming from abroad or leaving, and people moving to or from other U.S. counties, including immigrants already living in the United States. The census number shows that these factors are affecting cities, suburbs, and rural communities differently. Urban areas gained 1.6 million net new migrants since 2000, with a surplus of immigrants more than offsetting a loss of people who moved out to suburbs or rural areas. As a group, urban counties had 9.8 million more births than deaths, further bolstering their populations. Suburban and small metro counties have grown since 2000 because of gains in all the drivers of population change. They gained 11.7 million new residents by drawing former residents of U.S. urban and rural areas, as well as immigrants from abroad. On top of that, they had 12.1 million more births than deaths. It was a different picture for rural counties, however, where move-outs since 2000 exceeded move-ins. As a group, they had a net loss of 380,000 people who moved out. The loss would have been larger, more than 950,000 people, had it not been partly offset by about 600,000 new immigrants. The total population of rural counties grew only through natural increase. That is, they had 1.2 million more births than deaths. The pattern of births, deaths, and migration and immigration vary greatly among regions and generally illustrate the long-term trend of Americans favoring the Sun Belt states of the South and West over Northeastern or Midwestern states. These regional differences persist within each county type. Among rural counties, a majority in the Northeast and Midwest lost population since 2000. While a majority in the South, and especially the West, gained population. One factor behind the regional difference is that rural counties in the Northeast and Midwest were more likely than other rural counties to have more deaths than births. These counties also were more likely to have experienced a net loss of migrants, more people moving out than moving in. The population trends of rural counties are linked to their economic profiles. As a group, the nation's 391 rural farming counties, heavily concentrated in the Great Plains, have lost total population since 2000, while rural counties with other types of economies gained population. The total population of rural counties with recreation-based and government-based economies grew more since 2000 than the population of other rural county types. One reason recreation-based counties grew was that they had a net gain of new residents who moved from other counties, the only rural county type to have a gain in net domestic migration. An analysis by the Population Reference Bureau found that rural recreation-based counties were especially likely to have growing numbers of residents 65 and older, while rural farming-based counties were losing residents in that age group. Among urban areas, the Midwest had the largest share of population-losing counties since 2000. 42% of urban counties in this region, including the one that encompasses Chicago, that is Cook County, Illinois, Detroit, which is Wayne County, Michigan, and Cleveland, which is Cuyahoga County, Ohio, lost population. Among suburban and small metro counties, about a quarter of the ones in the Northeast and Midwest lost population since 2000, a higher share than in other regions. A majority of Northeast and Midwest suburban counties had a net gain of migrants, but that was mainly due to immigration. majority had a net loss of residents to urban or rural area counties during this period. Older adults are a higher share of the population in rural areas than in urban and suburban counties. A key demographic trend shaping the makeup of local populations, as well as the nation as a whole, is the rising number of older Americans. The baby boom generation, born between 1946 and 1964, began turning 65 in 2011, and all will have reached the age by 2030. While the population is aging in all three county types, this is happening more rapidly in U.S. suburban and small metro counties. The 65 and older population grew 39% in the suburbs since 2000, compared with 26% in urban and 22% in rural counties. Nationally and in each county type, the older adult population grew more sharply since 2000 than any other age group: young children, school-aged children, young adults, or middle-aged adults. In rural areas, the population younger than 18 declined during this period. As a result, in each county type, adults age 65 and older now make up a larger share of the total population than in 2000. As a group, rural counties skew older than suburban and urban counties. 18% of rural residents are 65 or older, versus 15% in suburban and small metro counties, and 13% in cities. Rural counties also have a smaller share of young adults than urban or suburban populations. Urban and suburban counties are becoming more racially and ethnically diverse at a much faster pace than rural counties. The nation is becoming more racially and ethnically diverse, but these changes have been more muted in rural counties compared with urban and suburban ones. The white share of the population fell 8% since 2000 in the suburbs, 7 points in the urban core, and only 3 points in rural counties. Overall, the U.S. population remains majority white, but not so in urban areas as a group. Among urban residents, 44% are white, compared with 65% in suburban and small metro counties, and 79% in rural counties. In fact, whites have become the minority in most urban counties. 53% of them are majority non-white since 2000. Only about 1 in 10 suburban and rural counties are majority non-white. While the share of the non-Hispanic whites has declined, the number of whites grew in the nation overall and in suburban counties as a whole since 2000, but the white population did not grow as sharply as other groups did, leading to a decline in the white share of the total U.S. and suburban populations. In urban counties, the decline in the issue of the white population was due both to a decrease in the number of whites and an increase in the size of other populations, chiefly Hispanics. In rural counties, the white population also decreased, and other groups also increased in size, but the impact was more modest on the white share of the population because whites are so largely a proportion of rural residents. The foreign-born population is not evenly distributed across county types. Immigrants tend to be concentrated in big metropolitan areas. In fact, about half live in urban counties, where they make up a higher share of the total than in suburban counties. There are gaps in poverty, education, and employment across county types. In addition to the three major demographic shifts that are reshaping urban, suburban, and rural counties in the United States, the aging of the population, changing racial and ethnic makeup, and the influx of new immigrants, there are significant differences in other important metrics across community types. These relate to the economic well-being of their residents. Poverty has increased more sharply in the suburbs than in urban or rural counties. Overall, the poverty rate is somewhat higher in rural, that is 18%, and urban, 17%, than in suburban ones, 14%. Poverty rates have risen in all three county types since the year 2000. Title of that article, What Unites and Divides Urban, Suburban, and Rural Communities? That posted to pewsocialtrends.org. Title of this article, The New Math of Saving for Retirement May Boil Down to This One Absurdly Simple Rule. why you should be saving at least 10% of your salary. This was published August 17, 2019 at the Brookings Institution and was written by Joshua Gottbaum. Eventually, I'll stop working. Most of us think that and know it will happen, but millions of us worry whether we're saving enough to live on once we do. We want to know, how much of my earnings should I set aside? What's the magic number? 3%? 5%? 10%? More? What your financial advisor won't tell you. Unfortunately, the retirement industry has spent decades largely avoiding the magic number question. There's no magic number for everyone, some say. It's complicated, say others. And then they offer, sometimes for a fee and sometimes for free, to take our money and invest it for us, often without telling us whether it'll be enough when the time comes. Why will no one give us a magic number? Well, they don't want to be legally responsible when the number turns out to be too low, which for some of us, especially those whose pay is low or whose investments are poor or who live long and need a nursing home for years, it will. The legal jitters are understandable, but they leave us in the dark about how much to save. Don't give up hope. There's research that can help. From institutions that don't have a conflict or interest because they don't invest or give advice. My favorite is the Employee Benefits Research Institute in Washington, D.C. EBRI, as it's called, gathered anonymous information on tens of millions of people and how they actually save. It won't tell people what to do, but from its research, there's a pretty useful rule of thumb for young people. Count on your fingers and save 10% now. Between you and your employer, set aside at least 10% of your paycheck. If your employer contributes 3%, then your share is at least 7%. If the company kicks in 5%, then you save at least 10%. If your employer does nothing, set aside at least 10% of each paycheck on your own. Of course, there'll be times when you're between jobs or you need your money for a pre-retirement age emergency. In those cases, you can put your money in a Roth individual retirement account. That way, you can take your contributions out without penalty. There are also Roth 401k accounts, though they have more complicated withdrawal rules. Don't let the fact that you might need money someday keep you from saving for retirement now. It's perfectly okay to consult a financial advisor and get more personalized recommendations. But if you can't or don't want to, or while you're waiting to get around to it, set aside enough so that, together with your employer match, you're putting aside at least 10%. People are living longer. That's both good and bad news. We hear about baby boomers moving into posh, active adult communities, but we also hear about disabled and bedridden elderly requiring years' worth of health aids and the constant help of their children. Either way, longer lives seem expensive. And our capacity to lay the groundwork for retirement can feel pinched from all directions. Life can be expensive, even in our earning years, with college tuition, housing, and medical costs in the stratosphere. Student loans and credit card debt intrude. Social Security, we're told, is at risk. Lifetime pensions are, for most, a thing of the mythical past. All that most of us feel we can count on is a retirement account that's at the mercy of the markets and, we suspect, doesn't have enough money in it. Many, of course, don't even have that. A contribution rate of 10% starting in your mid-20s cuts the risk of running out of money in retirement to about 30%. Experts often tell us how complicated this is to figure out and why we should hire them to do it for us. And it's easy to make it complicated. We can try to decide, now decades before we're ready to even think about retiring, what our future earnings will be and how long we'll work, what lifestyle we'd prefer in retirement, how much health care will cost decades down the road, how long we'll live after retirement, with a margin for error, of course, how our money should be invested, and what our investment returns will be, with, again, a margin of error. Not complicated enough? Add whether or not we'll need funds at hand to support children or parents or other family members. The result is confusion. Some people get financial advice, others turn to online retirement calculators. Many, sadly, do nothing at all, falling back on a vow of resignation, I'll just keep working. Spoiler alert, almost no one who says they'll work until they die ends up doing so. For still others, it means saving too little. So how can EBRI's model help? It estimates the risk of running out of money after retirement by taking into account many more factors than the usual online calculator. Contributions, market changes, Social Security benefits, and salary growth, as well as a range of health outcomes and longevity prospects. It can then estimate the risk that for particular savings rates and income levels, a person's expenses in retirement will overwhelm their savings plus Social Security benefits. For this article, EBRI provided projections for today's 24-year-olds at multiple income levels. We'll interpolate the results to reflect the median income of today's 25-year-olds, which is $30,000. The projections assume that people will earn more as they get older. We then applied EBRI's projection to three millennials. Their names have been changed, but they are all in their mid-20s. We'll assume they're average earners. Philip, working in a startup, contributes 3% of pay to a retirement account. His employer contributes nothing. Ida, an office worker, contributes 3%, which her employer matches for a total of 6%. John, working for a financial firm, contributes 8%. His employer contributes 4% for a total of 12%. Are they contributing enough, or too much, or too little? Well, here's how, based on EBRI's model, our millennials and their different savings practices would end up in retirement. If Philip, from a current salary of $30,000, continues to contribute 3%, he has a 56% chance of running through both his retirement savings and Social Security in his lifetime. If he were earning $40,000 now, the odds improve, but his chance of running out of money still exceeds 40%. Clearly, then, 3% is not enough. Ida, being a woman, will likely live longer, so her 6% total contribution will have to last longer, and the probability that neither it nor Social Security will be enough is 47%. Sounds like 6% is too low as well. John, contributing 12% of pay, has less than one chance in four, that is 23%, of running out of money. Overall, the EBRI simulation model suggests that in the income ranges of most millennials, a contribution rate of 10% starting in a worker's mid-20s cuts the risk of running out of money in retirement to about 30%, less than one chance in three. Contributing more than 10% when you can will give you a better cushion. Of course, everyone's situation is and will be different, so 10% is a guideline, not a guarantee. By now, you're probably thinking this is easier said than done, and you're right. Saving for retirement is like dieting, in that we're better at making resolutions and excuses than making progress. But technology makes the savings part easier, too. More and more employer plans will sign you up automatically. If your employer doesn't have a plan, you can set up a Roth IRA with a bank or an investment company and have a portion of each paycheck deposited automatically. Some states, including Oregon, Illinois, California, and Maryland, whose program I chair, that is the author, are setting up IRA programs for small businesses that don't offer retirement plans. The good news is that in one respect, retirement savings is easier than dieting. If you fall off the wagon, you can start again and feel better immediately. Yes, life is complicated. Retirement plans don't always turn out as planned, but if while worrying about everything else, we each adhered to the 10% rule as much as we are able, there would be a lot less retirement insecurity and a lot more gold in the golden years. Joshua Gottbaum is a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution focusing on retirement issues. He's worked in finance and government for over 40 years. And these are his personal views. The title of this piece, The New Math of Saving for Retirement, may boil down to this one absurdly simple rule. You should be saving at least 10% of your salary. Thank you for joining us for Financial News. My name is Michael Amy.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.